Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Our world of 7 billion humans coexists with and depends on the natural world. Across the globe, nations have set aside what are called protected areas, landscapes where some human activities are regulated. While those landscapes differ widely, there are common issues: economics, politics, the interests and needs of local people, tourism, and in an era of climate change, coordination of management across man-made boundaries. This summer, the United States Forest Service and the University of Montana are sponsoring a remarkable exchange. Professionals from nearly 20 nations are visiting Montana for nearly 20 days, exchanging experience and knowledge. With us to discuss this are Dave Campbell, longtime Forest Service District Ranger, Olivier Ando Assam, Research Officer of the Executive Secretary of the National Park Agency of the Nation of Gabon in Africa, and Tamar Kvantalyani of the Agency of Protected Areas of the Nation of Georgia. Many thanks to you all for joining us on Home Ground. Dave, tell us about how this idea came about.
Well, the international seminar is sponsored chiefly by international programs of the U.S. Forest Service in cooperation with the University of Montana and has been with the University of Idaho in order to interchange information and help assist other countries. The International Programs Office in Washington, D.C. exists. It's a very small part of the Forest Service. And we get at the one of their other objectives is to try to internationalize the Forest Service here domestically to help employees think more globally and broaden their perspectives.
So how long has this program been in existence?
This is the 16th year of this international seminar.
Is this your first involvement with one of these seminars?
No, I've been involved with the international seminar for about the last 8 years. 6 years before I retired, and the 2 years since I've been retired, I've stayed with them longer.
Has it been worth your while, and if so, why?
Oh, it's been tremendously worth my while. It's been wonderful to meet so many people from so many countries and hear their stories and put our situation in the United States into an international perspective and realize just how blessed we are and what we might be able to do to assist those countries and what we might learn from them.
Those are interesting principles. How do they apply in the real world? For example, what have you learned from some conservation practice in another country that is meaningful to you?
Well, I think that the community-based natural resource management, the whole idea of communities being heavily engaged in decision-making and empowered, particularly in Africa, that's been very, very useful. And some countries in Africa do a marvelous job of that. Namibia, for example, has conservancies that knits together private landowners to conserve species and habitats across larger landscapes. And it's similar to the land trust idea we do here in the United States, but without nearly the support of government in some ways that we enjoy. So it's community-based for sure.
Tamar Kvantalyani.
Yes.
Nice to have you in Montana.
Nice to meet you.
Tell us about what led you to want to be a conservationist.
All right, now I'm 27 years old, so my father used to be a human geographer, and therefore I decided to follow his route, so I did my bachelor's and first master in human geography, and later I continued for another master's in nature policy and environmental policy. And I wrote my thesis about the protected areas, so then later I was so much interested that I decided to continue work there. So now still I'm there at the protected area sphere.
I appreciate that history, but my question specifically is why? Why did you decide to do it? Why does it matter to you?
So generally, I really much like to deal with the issues related to the conservation. Moreover, Georgia, my country, is so rich with biodiversity, and the issues of environment just raised like couple of years ago, and now it's on its way of development. So I really like to contribute in this. So I decided to be in this sphere, and I really much like to be the part of this sphere.
I think most of us, including myself, don't know much about the nation of Georgia. I remember it was part of the Soviet Union and into the South. Describe, if you would, the geography, and you said it was high in biodiversity. Tell us about it.
Georgia, with its location, is located between the Caspian and the Black Sea, so in the Caucasus, and it borders with 4 countries. And because of its geographical location and the climatic zones, its biodiversity is really rich, both with the habitats and the species, plants and animals as well.
What kind of animals, for example?
So we have this IUCN red list, and we have this leopard, Caucasian tour, and many others that are really extinct and exist only in the Caucasus. So we do a lot to conserve them, and we have also some programs like a conservation programs and reintroduction programs. So we reintroduced some species from the Azerbaijan. So we have tight cooperation with them to conserve the species that are really extinct for the Caucasus. So we have also the plants that are in the red list.
When you say the red list, people won't know what the red list is. Is that an endangered species?
Yes, this is the list of endangered species.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're reintroducing those.
Yes.
I interrupted you.
So with the animal species, we are introducing some of them, but what we have, we are conserving them. About the plant species, we also have the red list species the plant species, and we are also conserving. So I might say that 90% of the species, plant species we have in Georgia, you can find at our protected areas.
You mentioned, I think, Caucasian tour. What is a tour? Pardon my ignorance.
It's a mountain goat.
Dave was talking about the extensive use of community-based conservation in Africa. Georgia was part of the Soviet Union. It had a pretty hierarchical structure. What is the situation in Georgia in terms of the engagement of the communities, local communities, in conservation management decisions?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. One of the main problems we're dealing with the protected areas and generally with the field of environment is the lack of community involvement. So the system is very centralized. But now at this stage, since 2007, we are trying to include them as much as possible. So we have created some of the councils together with local communities, and we are trying to include them in the decision-making at the field level, in the administrations of the protected areas, so that they feel that they are part of it, they benefit from it, and they have a positive attitude, because we have some experiences in some of the protected areas where they had a negative attitude towards the protected areas, but the trend is it's changing.
Have you personally been involved in this transition, engaging the community more actively in decision-making?
Yes, I have.
Tell me about it.
So I have attended and participated in the meetings with the councils I mentioned before.
What councils of whom? Who is it?
With the local population. I mean, including stakeholders at the field level. It can be us as the Agency of Protected Areas, administration at the field level, local communities, I mean people living nearby the protected areas, and also the local municipalities. So all the stakeholders that are engaged in the decision-making and managing of protected areas.
All right. Now, give me an example of a community or something that you participated in so we can understand what you're talking about,
okay.
How it works.
All right, so we have one project financed by the German government, and they have this new approach calling financial participatory approach. So at the field level, they are giving money to people. It's like a competition. So people are bringing their ideas. For example, they want to have a bridge to repair guest houses and use them as a guest houses later, their houses. or having some kind of ecotourism. It might be horse riding. And I participated as a representative of the agency in two of such competitions, and seeing myself how people's attitudes, how surprised they were, and how their attitude changed towards protected areas, I mean in a positive way.
Let me make sure I understand. Germany offers money to encourage innovative ideas from local people that obviously have to be good for local people, but that are good for conservation also. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I might add a little bit. So Germany is one of our biggest donors, supporting for developing of protected areas, and they pay much attention on the involvement of local populations. So they have tried this in Southern America, this financial participatory approach that worked successfully. So they decided to transfer it in Georgia as well, and that was the issue.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with three international specialists about the complex issues of managing land to benefit both people and nature. Olivier, why did you decide to work in conservation?
I decided to work in conservation because I like animals, specifically elephants.
And when in your life did you decide that you liked elephants?
When I was young, 5 years old, I saw my first elephant in the National Park of Lopé.
Now that's a wild elephant.
Wild elephant. Forest elephant, exactly.
So you're 5 years old, you see a wild elephant. What was your reaction?
I remember that I was afraid when I saw my first elephant. But the person who was with me said me that, don't panic. Just see.
Just see.
Yeah.
Looking at you, I can see you're no longer 5 years old. What is the work of your organization in relation to elephants now?
My organization has the mission to protect elephants in Gabon.
All right. What's the threat?
The poaching. The elephant poaching.
Poaching?
Poaching, yeah.
Okay, now I'm familiar, generally speaking, with what I will call the ivory trade, where elephants are shot and their tusks are cut out and sent, I don't know where they send them, China, Asia. Is that what you're talking about, that process of poaching?
The poaching elephant is caused by the ivory trafficking. It is very lucrative.
Very lucrative.
Yeah. In 8 years, Gabon's lost 11,000 elephants.
In 8 years, 11,000 elephants?
Yeah.
To poaching?
Due to the poaching, yeah.
Okay, people make money from the ivory traffic. How much money are we talking about?
Ivory of one elephant represents $1,000.
And I'm guessing that $1,000 represents a lot of money to most people in Gabon. Is that fair?
Yeah, that represents much money. We can buy a motorbike with this.
So with that sort of financial incentive, how does your organization prevent poaching?
It's very incentive to kill elephant, but in Gabon, when you kill an elephant, you can go to jail.
The experience in our country is that if there's a high enough financial incentive, some people are willing to risk going to jail to get that money. Now, and you've told us that in the last 8 years, 11,000 elephants have been killed in Gabon. That suggests that just the threat or risk of going to jail is not enough to stop the poaching. So what do you do? What can you do that you haven't done already? They already can go to jail. How else can you reduce the number of elephants killed by poachers?
In fact, in Gabon, many poachers come from other countries. there are not many Gabonese poachers.
All right.
And to reduce the ivory trafficking, we must develop an African communication against poaching, elephant poaching.
So you're saying it's the poaching's international, it's going to take an international cooperative response.
To reduce the ivory trafficking, it's very important to develop an African communication against poaching first, with the next step, all the world.
My understanding from people who are very familiar with the international poaching problem of elephants and the efforts at international cooperation is that it's weak, it's not adequate to do the job, and that's why the poaching is getting worse. Let me go back to what Dave and Tamar talked about in terms of community engagement. Is it possible, you said that the poachers are not primarily Gabonese people. Is it possible to get more cooperation from the local community to help you stop poaching?
The contribution of the local communities will be get information to agency to prepare plans, the mission to fight these people who are poaching elephants.
I'm hearing you say that the local communities are in a position to inform the agency that poaching is taking place. Let's say you get a report. What do you do about it?
When the agency has an information from local community about the poacher, we contact our army team in the park.
Army as in army. I mean, that's military.
Yeah, military.
You have a military team in the park.
In the park. And we contact this team to plan a mission to go where the people saw this poacher, suspect poacher.
Now, local people can pick up the phone or not. That's their decision. Does your agency have a program or anything that it does to encourage that sort of cooperation from local people?
We involve local people in the reduction and conception of plan management of the park. And we share information. When we have opportunities of jobs, local people are the priority candidates.
They're for the this priority job. Candidates.
Yeah.
So you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, you're engaging the citizens in decision making and you're giving them a financial incentive because they are the first ones to be hired if there are new job opportunities.
Yeah.
Economic incentives to local people to support conservation seems to be a very broad and common and shared theme internationally from what I've seen. It certainly is true in Montana. Tamar, what's your experience in Georgia? Is it an important question to make the economy work for people that is compatible with conservation? And if so, how do you go about it?
I think it's one of the most important issues. So what we are trying to do is that we have 18 field administrations, and we try to engage these people so to make job opportunities for them. So the staff we have at place, they are all the local population. Moreover, we are trying to develop ecotourism activities. So this might be the horse riding, so guest houses and other activities that we give an opportunity to the locals to be engaged and to take a lead on. So there are some kind of incentives for them. And I might say that one example, it's mountainous area, Tushati protected areas. It's very remote and very beautiful place. And in 2007, we had a local population had only 2 guest houses there, and now they reached already 45.
In one community, from 2 to 45?
2 to 45.
So from the point of view of your agency, which is a conservation agency, ecotourism is a plus. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Are you directly involved in promoting ecotourism, in assisting local people?
Yes, with the protected areas, we are one of the promoters. So sometimes we give the, maybe it's architecture and buildings to concessions, and we are not leading, and we are not the owner of this, but we promote and help these locals to develop ecotourism there. For example, in so-called Javaheti protected areas, we developed the factory for traditional textile for the women. So they are now working there and selling their carpets and other stuff, and they are taking income from it.
That's an interesting example, but it's just one example. Is George's experience that ecotourism has a serious potential for growth and economic impact?
Yes, I can say that since 2007 until 2014, there was a huge growth. So in 2007, there were approximately 7,000 visitors, while in 2014, it reached approximately 400,000 visitors.
Now, that's hard to get my head around. 7,000 to 400,000?
Yeah, that's right.
How did that come about?
The thing is that incentives we create also not only for the local population but generally for the visitors. These are the educational trails, ecotourism trails, some kind of other activities, facilities. And also the ecotourism incentives for the local population, that they developed it further. So it attracted more visitors. And I think that this was the main reason why there was such a huge growth.
Well, I'm going to suggest that, I mean, I've seen photographs. You just gave a lecture at this seminar.
Yes.
I had no idea that Georgia was so spectacularly beautiful. It's part of the Caucasus Mountains.
Yes.
And I think you said some of the peaks are higher than the Alps, right?
Yeah.
So I'm guessing maybe there was some promotion of that outside the country or not. Would you help me understand that?
To be honest, the promotion, it's more inside the country.
Okay, so are these visitors Georgians or are these visitors foreigners?
Foreigners. Most of the part of the visitors are foreigners.
Okay.
And I think that one of the way that information is spread, it's just that they are saying to their friends and relatives and so on. And also the donors that we have from international society, they also spread these ideas and
information.
Okay, that's
what I'm talking about. They are promoting it actively,
yeah,
as
exactly.
A way of...
They admire it. They like it so much.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with three international specialists about the complex issues of managing land to benefit both people and nature. Dave, back to you. It's my experience, and I've been working with the Forest Service pretty seriously for about 15 years, that during that period of time, it's become much more focused on community engagement. Am I right, wrong? What would you say?
No, I think you're right. I think that it's become really evident that working on controversial subjects, on controversial issues, timber harvest, mm-hmm. What does restoration mean? What does ecosystem management mean? All of those things that are complex are best done at the community, where you can sit down with people of differing views at a table and hammer that out. And building from the middle and bringing the extreme views from either end into the middle when possible has been really the only way that the timber wars of the 80s have finally ceased.
It's also my experience that that perception or that realization is not evenly shared in the Forest Service, that there's still a fair number of people, let's call them the old guard, whatever you want to call them, that seem to feel that collaboration somehow weakens their traditional authority. Would you agree or disagree with my assessment?
I would agree. I would agree that, like any organization, there are some people that take a little longer to smell the coffee and wake up to the new reality, and I'm sure that's the case here. Those that have sat through collaboration, and sometimes it seems to take a lot of patience and it takes a lot of effort, but it's really the only way forward for a public land management agency in particular when you're trying to bring the public along with you.
We're running a little short of time, and there's one of the themes in this conference that's highly important. It's called Transboundary Management in the Face of Climate Change. And it argues that working just strictly along organizational lines and man-made boundaries is not enough. Olivier pointed this out in relation to elephants. He's talking about getting neighboring countries involved. In brief, what's the Forest Service's sense for this transboundary cooperation?
Well, I think the cooperation occurs across geographic boundaries as well as agency jurisdictional boundaries. Climate change is a good example. It affects the whole world. We can't solve it in one country, nor can we solve management problems in one state or one county. We have to cross those boundaries between the states to coordinate and to find common solutions, and across agencies, where the Forest Service abuts a national park, and that management affects both.
Okay, it's one thing to say it has to be done, and it's another to say that it's feasible because of political turf, all sorts of reasons. Do you think it's feasible?
Well, I think it's feasible, and I think it requires some leadership from agency heads on down to try to enforce that cooperation among them. And then it starts at the ground level with the people where really they'll see the gains where the boundaries meet one another.
Finally, let me ask our two guests. Olivier, somebody spent a lot of money to make this seminar possible. There's a lot of international travel. You're here for an extended period of time. Is it worth it? Is it worth your time and energy to do this? And if so, why?
My benefits for this seminar is firstly, chair experience with the other countries, with the United States, to improve methods and planning of protected areas. And at least, know all tools to involve local population about conflict, humans, wildlife.
And Tamar, what would you say to the same question?
I think it's totally worth it. I think the great people here and sharing their experiences, I think the issues related to protected areas are some kind of similar, but the innovations and the solutions might be different that can be used by other countries. So it's really worth it, and I might take this opportunity to thank you and the U.S. Forest Service and Montana University for this great opportunity. Thanks.
On that note, I regret to say we're out of time, and I want to thank all of you for being with us on Home Ground. To our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.